I caught my breath in astonishment. This seemed to be a large chamber, I suppose 50 or 60 feet across, and on the walls there were strange carvings, carvings which I failed to understand. It seemed to be very strange people dressed in remarkable clothing which appeared to cover them from head to foot, or, more accurately, from neck to foot, because on their heads they had a representation of what seemed to be a transparent globe. Above us, as I looked up, there seemed to be an immense cube, and at the end of that I could just discern a fleecy cloud floating by. My guide broke into my thoughts. "This is a very strange area, Lobsang," he told me. "Thousands and thousands of years ago there was a mighty civilization upon this earth. It was known as the Time of Atlantis. Some of the people of the Western world, to which in later years you will go, think of Atlantis as a legend, as an imaginary place dreamed up by some great storyteller. Well," he mused, "to my regret I have to tell you that many people will think that you have dreamed up your own true experiences, but never mind how much you are doubted, never mind how much you are disbelieved, you know the truth, you will live the truth. And here in this chamber you have proof that there was Atlantis." He turned and led the way yet further into this strange tunnel. For a time we walked in absolute inky darkness, our breath coming hard in the stale, dead air. Then again there came the freshness, from somewhere a pleasant breeze was blowing. The deadness vanished, and soon we saw a glimmer of light ahead of us. I could see my guide's figure bulking in the tunnel, limned by light ahead of me. Now with fresh air in my lungs I hurried to catch up with him. Again he stopped in a large chamber. Here there were more strange things. Someone had apparently carved great shelves in the rock, and on those shelves there were strange artifacts which were without any meaning whatever to me. I looked at them, and gently touched some of these things. They seemed to me machines. There were great discs with strange grooves on them. Some of the discs appeared to be of stone, and they were, perhaps, 6 feet across, with an undulating wave on their surface, and in the center of the disc a hole. It meant nothing to me. So I turned from fruitless speculation and examined the paintings and the carvings which adorned the walls. They were strange pictures: large cats that walked on two legs, tree houses with curled cats inside. There were things which seemed to be floating in the air, and below on what was obviously the ground humans were pointing upwards at these things. It was all so much above me that it made my head ache. My guide said, "These are passages which reach to the ends of the earth. The earth has a spine, just as we have Lobsang, but the spine of the earth is of rock. In our spine we have a tunnel, it is filled with liquid in our case, and our spinal cord goes through. Here this is the spine of the earth, and this tunnel was man-made in the days of Atlantis, when they knew how to make rock flow like water without generating heat. Look at this rock," he said, turning and rapping on a wall. "This rock is fused to almost total hardness. If you take a great stone and slam it against this rock face, you would do no harm whatever except to the stone, which may shatter. I have traveled extensively, and I know that this rocky spine extends from the North Pole to the South Pole." He motioned that we should sit, so we sat cross-legged upon the floor right beneath the hole, which extended up to the open air and through which we could see the darkness of the sky. "Lobsang," said my guide, "there are many things on this earth which people do not understand. There are things inside this earth too, because, contrary to common belief, the earth is indeed hollow, and there is another race of people living inside this earth. They are more developed than we are, and sometimes some of them come out of the earth in special vehicles." He stopped and pointed to one of the strange things in the pictures, and then he continued, "These vehicles come out of the earth, and they fly around on the outside of the earth to see what people are doing, and to ascertain if their own safety is jeopardized by the folly of those whom they term the outsiders. Inside the earth," I thought, "what a strange place to be living. It must be frightfully dark down there. I don't like the thought of living in the dark, but a lamp is such a comfort." My guide laughed at me as he picked up my thoughts, and he said, "Oh, it's not dark inside the earth, Lobsang. They have a sun something like we have, but theirs is much smaller and very much more powerful. They have much more than we have, they are very much more intelligent. But in the days before you, you shall know more about the people of the inner earth. Come." He rose to his feet and went off through a tunnel which I had not seen, a tunnel diverging to the right. It sloped down, down. We seemed to walk endlessly in darkness. Then my guide bade me stop where I was. I could hear him fiddling and fumbling about, and there was a clatter that sounded like a rock being moved. Then there were a few sparks as he struck the flint upon steel. There came a dull glow as the tinder ignited. He blew upon it, and then as the tinder burst into small flame he thrust the end of some sort of stick into the flame, where it burst into brilliant light. He held his torch at arm's length slightly above him and called me to come to his side. I did so, and he pointed to the wall in front of us. The tunnel ended, and in front of us was an absolutely smooth impenetrable surface which gleamed brightly in the flickering light of the flare. "That Lobsang," said my guide, "is as hard as diamond. In fact, some of us came here years ago with a diamond and we tried to scratch the surface and we ruined the diamond. This is a passage which leads to the world inside. It was sealed, we believe, by the inside worlders to save their civilization during a great flood which struck this earth. We believe that if this was opened, that is, if we could open it, people would come pouring out and overwhelm us for daring to intrude upon their privacy. We of the higher Lama class have often visited this place and tried to commune with those below by telepathy. They have received our messages, but they want nothing to do with us. They tell us that we are warlike, that we are as ignorant children trying to blow up the world, trying to ruin peace. They tell us by telepathy that they are keeping check on us, and if necessary they will intervene. So we can go no further here. This is the end. This is the blocked line between the upper and the inner worlds. All right, we will go back to the chamber." He carefully extinguished the flare, and we felt our way back to where the glowing light from the sky above shone down through the hole in the roof. In that chamber again the Lama pointed in another direction, and said, "If we had the strength and the time, we could walk right away to the South Pole by following the tunnel. Some of us have covered miles and miles, bringing ample food with us and camping by night, or what we deem to be night. We traveled endless miles over 6 months, and at times we came up through a tunnel and found that we were in a strange land indeed, but we dared not show ourselves. Always the exits were very, very carefully camouflaged. We sat down and ate our small meal. We had been traveling a long time and exhaustion was setting in for me, although my guide seemed to be immune from exhaustion or even ordinary tiredness. He talked to me and told me all manner of things. He said, "When I was being trained as you are being trained now, I too went through the ceremony of the small death, and I was shown the Akashic record. I was shown the things that had been, and I saw that our Tibet was once a pleasant watering place beside a glittering sea. The temperatures were warm, perhaps even excessively so, and there was profuse foliage and palm trees and all manner of strange fruits which then meant nothing at all to me. But from the Akashic record I saw a truly wondrous civilization. I saw strange craft in the sky. I saw people with remarkable cone-shaped heads who walked about, who had their entertainments, who made love, but also made war. Then, as I saw in this record, the whole country shook and the sky turned black. The clouds were as dark as night, their undersides lit with flickering games. The land shuddered and opened. It seemed that everything was fire. Then the sea rushed into the newly opened land, and there were tremendous explosions, explosion after explosion. It seemed that the sun stood still and the moon rose no more. People were becoming overwhelmed by tremendous floods of water. People were being seared to death by flames which appeared from I know not where, but the flames flickered with a vile purplish glow, and as they touched people the flesh fell from their bones, leaving the skeletons to fall to the ground with a clatter. Day succeeded day and the turmoil increased, although one would have said that such a thing was impossible, and then there came a ripping, searing explosion, and everything turned dark. Everything was as black as the soot which comes from too many butter lamps burning untrimmed. After a time which I could not calculate, he said, the gloom became lighter, the darkness was diminishing, and when the light of day finally appeared after I know not how long, I looked at the picture with utter terror. Now I found that I was looking at a vastly different landscape. The sea was no more. A ring of mountains had sprung up in the darkness and encircled what previously had been the city of a most high civilization. I looked about me in fascinated horror. The sea had gone. The sea, well, there was no more sea. Instead there were mountains and ring upon ring of mountains. Now I could tell that we were thousands of feet higher, and although I was seeing the Akashic record, I was sensing as well, I could sense the rarity of the air. There was no sign of life here, no sign whatever. And as I looked, the picture vanished and I found myself back from whence I had started, in the deepest levels of the mountain of Potala, where I had been undergoing the ceremony of the little death and given much information. For a time we sat there meditating upon the past, and my guide said to me, "I see you are meditating, or attempting to meditate. Now there are two very good ways of meditating, Lobsang. You must be content, you must be tranquil. You cannot meditate with a disturbed mind, and you cannot meditate with a whole gathering of people. You have to be alone or with just one person whom you love." He regarded me, and then said, "You must always look at something black or at something which is white. If you look at the ground, you may be distracted by a grain of pebble, or you may be doubly distracted by some insect. To meditate successfully, you must always gaze at that which offers no attraction to the eye, either entire black or pure white. Your eyes then become sick of the whole affair and become, as it were, disassociated from the brain. So then the brain, having nothing to distract it optically, is free to obey what your subconscious requires, and thus if you have instructed your subconscious that you are going to meditate, you will. You will find in that sort of meditation that your senses are heightened, your perceptions more acute, and that is the only meditation worthy of the name. In the years which will come to you, you will encounter many cults proffering meditation at a price. But that is not meditation as we understand it, nor is it meditation as we want it. It is just something which cultists play with, and it has no virtue." So saying, he rose to his feet, exclaiming, "We must get back, for the day is far advanced. We shall have to spend another night in the mountains, for it is too late to start off for Chakpurai." He set off down the tunnel and I jumped to my feet and scurried after him. I had no desire to be left in this place where inside worlders, or whatever they like to call themselves, could perhaps pop up and take me down with them. I did not know what they would be like, I did not know how they would like me, and I certainly did not want to stay alone in the dark of that place. So I hurried, and at last we reached again the entrance by which we had entered. The horse and the pony were resting peacefully, and we sat down beside them and made our simple preparations for our meal. The light was already far gone, much of the valley was in darkness. At our altitude the western sun was yet shining upon us, but the orb itself was dipping ever more deeply beneath the mountains on its path to illumine other parts of the world before returning to us. After some small talk we rolled ourselves in our blankets again and committed ourselves to sleep. Chapter 5. Life at Chakpurai was hectic. The amount of things I had to learn really shocked me: herbs where they grew, when to gather them, and be sure that if they were gathered at the wrong time they would be quite useless. That, I was taught, was one of the great secrets of herbalism. The plants, or the leaves, or the barks, or the roots could only be gathered efficiently within the span of 2 or 3 days. The moon had to be right, the stars had to be right, and then the time had to be right also. One must also feel tranquil when gathering such herbs because, so I was told, one who gathered herbs when in a bad mood would make the herbs not worth the taking. Then we had to dry the things. That was quite a task. Only certain parts of herbs were useful. Some needed to have just the tips of the leaves removed, others needed to have stalks or bark, and each plant or herb had to be treated in its own individual way and regarded with respect. We took the barks and rubbed them between hands specially cleaned for the purpose, an ordeal in itself, and so the bark would be reduced to a certain size, sort of granular powder. And then everything had to be laid out on a spotlessly clean floor, no polish on this floor, just rub, rub, rub until there was no dust, no stain, no mark. Then everything was left out and left to nature to dry seal the virtues of the herb within that which we had before us. We made herbal tea, that is, infusions of steeped herbs, and I could never understand how people could get the noxious stuff down their throats. It seemed to be an axiom that the worse the taste and the stronger the smell, the more beneficial the medicine, and I will say from my own observation that if a medicine is sufficiently evil tasting, the poor wretched patient will get better out of fright rather than take the medicine. It is like when one goes to the dentist, the pain will have vanished so that one hesitates on the doorstep wondering whether one should go through with it. It reminds me rather of the pallid and anxious young man, a recent bridegroom, who was accompanying his very, very pregnant bride to the hospital, for her time was upon her. As he turned before the reception desk, he said, "Oh gee, honey, are you sure you really want to go through with this?" As a special student, one who had to learn more, faster, I was not confined only to Chakpuri. My time was also devoted to studies at the Potala. Here I had all the most learned lamas, each to teach me his own specialty. I learned various forms of medicine. I learned acupuncture, and in later years, with the weight of many years of experience, I came to the inescapable conclusion that acupuncture was a wondrous thing indeed for those of the East, those who have been long conditioned to acupuncture. But when, as I found in China, you get skeptical Westerners to deal with, well, unfortunately, they were hypnotized by their own disbelief of anything that didn't come from God's own country. There were sacred passages to be seen deep, deep below the mountain of Potala. Down below there was an immense cave with what seemed to be an inland sea. That, I was told, was a remnant of the time so long ago when Tibet was a pleasant land beside the sea. Certainly, in that immense cave I saw strange remnants, skeletons of fantastic creatures which much, much later in my life I recognized to be mastodons, dinosaurs, and other exotic fauna. Then in many places one would find great slabs of natural crystal, and in the natural crystal one could see kelp, different types of seaweed, and occasionally a perfectly preserved fish completely embedded in clear crystal. These were indeed regarded as sacred objects, as messages from the past. Kite flying was an art at which I excelled. Once a year we went into the high mountains to gather rare herbs and to generally have recreation from the quite arduous life of a lamasery. Some of us, the more foolhardy of us, flew in man-lifting kites, and I thought first that here was that which had been described in the prophecy, but then I came to my senses and realized it could not be a man-lifting kite, because these kites were connected to the earth by ropes, and should a rope be broken or escape from the clutches of the many monks, then the kite would fall and there would be the death of the person riding it. There were quite a number of interviews with the inmost one, our 13th Dalai Lama, and I felt such love and respect for him. He knew that in a few more years Tibet would be an enslaved state, but the gods had foretold and the gods must be obeyed. There could be no real form of resistance because there were no real weapons in Tibet. You cannot oppose a man with a rifle when all you have is a prayer wheel or a string of beads. I received my instructions, my sacred orders, from the great 13th. I received guidance and advice, and the love and understanding which my own parents had completely denied me, and I decided that come what may I would do my best. There had been times when I had seen my father. Each time he had turned away from me frozen-faced, as if I was the lowest of the low, beneath his contempt. Once, almost at the end of my stay in the Potala, I had visited my parents at home. Mother sickened me by her excess formality, by the manner in which she treated me purely as a visiting lama. Father, true to his belief, would not receive me and shut himself in his study. Yasodhara, my sister, looked at me as if I was some freak or figment from a particularly bad nightmare. Eventually I was summoned again to the inmost one's apartments and told much that I do not propose to repeat here. One thing he did tell me was that on the very next week I would go to China to study as a medical student at the University of Chongqing. But, I was instructed, I must take a different name. I could not use my own name of Rampa, or certain elements of a Chinese rebellion would seize me and use me as a bargaining tool. There was in existence in China at that time a faction devoted to the overthrow of the government and who were prepared to adopt any methods whatever to achieve their objective. So I was told to pick a name. Now, how could a poor Tibetan boy, one just approaching manhood, admittedly, but how could he pick a Chinese name when he didn't know anything about China? I pondered on that awful question, and then unbidden, unexpectedly, a name appeared in my mind. I would call myself Quan Suo, which in one dialect of China meant priest of the hill. Surely that was an appropriate name. But it was a name which people found difficult to pronounce, Western people, that is, and so it soon became shortened to Quan. Well, the name was settled. My papers were in order. I was given special papers from the Potala testifying to my status and to the standards I had reached because, as I was told and as I found to be absolutely correct later, Western people would not believe anything unless it was on paper, or could be felt or torn to pieces. So my papers were prepared and handed to me with great ceremony. Soon came the day when I had to ride all the way to Tongking. My guide, the Lama Minya, donned up, and I had a most sad farewell. He knew I would not see him again while he was in the body. He gave me many assurances that I would meet him often in the astral. I had a party of people going with me to protect me from Chinese brigands and to be able to report my safe arrival at Tongking. We started off and rode steadily all along through the highlands of the plain of Lhasa, and then we descended to the lowlands, a place which was almost tropical in the exotic flora, wonderful rhododendrons. We passed many lamaseries, and quite frequently we spent the night in them if they happened to be on our path at a suitable time. I was a lama, actually I was an abbot, and a recognized incarnation, thus when we went to a lamasery we were indeed given special treatment. But I did not welcome such special treatment because each time it reminded me of the hardships of my life yet to be endured. Eventually we left the borders of Tibet and entered China. Here, in China, every large village seemed to be infested with Russian communists, white men who were standing up usually on an ox cart telling the workers of the wonders of communism and how they should rise and massacre those who were landowners, telling them how China belonged to the people. Well, now apparently it does, and what a mess they have made of it. The days passed, and our seemingly endless journey became shorter. It was quite annoying to be accosted by certain of the Chinese peasants who gaped at me because I looked somewhat like a Westerner. I had grey eyes instead of brown, and my hair was very dark but still not shiny black, so the story went about that I was a Russian in disguise. Nowadays, since my life in the West, I have had all manner of strange tales told about me. One tale which amused me immensely was to the effect that I was really a German who had been sent to Lhasa by Hitler so that I could learn all the secrets of the occult and then I would come back to Berlin and win the war for Hitler by magical means. Well, in those days I didn't even know there was such a man as Hitler. It is a most remarkable thing how a Westerner will believe everything except that which is utterly true. The more true a matter, the more difficult the Westerner finds it to believe. But while on the subject of Hitler and Tibetans, it is a fact that a small group of Tibetans were captured by the Nazis during the war and were compelled to go to Berlin, but they certainly did nothing to help him win the war, as history proves. At last we turned a corner in the road, and then we came in sight of the old city of Tongking. This city was built on high cliffs and far down below the river flowed. One of the rivers was particularly familiar to me, and that was the Keeling. So the high city of Tongking with its stepped streets with many a cobble was washed at its base by two rivers, the Yangtze and the Keeling. Where the two met, a fresh branch was formed, and so the city appeared from afar to be an island. 780 steps we climbed up to the city itself. We gazed like yokels at the shops and what to us seemed to be brilliantly lit stores containing articles which were completely beyond our understanding. Things in windows glittered, from many stores came noises, foreigners speaking to each other out of boxes, and then there came blasts of music out of other boxes. It was all a complete marvel to us, and I, knowing that I would have to spend a long time in such surroundings, began almost to quake with fear at the thought. My retinue was embarrassing me by the manner in which they gaped. Each of the men was shaking with nervousness, and each of them had his mouth open and eyes wide open too. I thought we must look a sorry bunch of country bumpkins gazing like this. But then I thought we weren't here for that, after all. I had to register at the university, and so we made our way there. My companions waited in the grounds outside while I entered and made my formal appearance, producing the envelope which I had so carefully safeguarded all the way from Lhasa. I worked hard in the university. My form of education had been quite different from that which was demanded by the university system, and so I had to work at least twice as hard. The principal of the university had warned me that conditions would be difficult. He said that he had been qualified in the latest American systems, and with his very capable staff, he was bringing a mixture of Chinese and American medicine and surgery to the students. The academic work was hard because I knew nothing of electricity, but I soon learned. Anatomy was easy. I had studied that quite thoroughly with the disposers of the dead in Lhasa, and it amused me greatly when first we were ushered into the dissecting rooms where dead bodies lay about to find so many of the students turn a pale green and become violently sick, while others just fainted away on the floor. It was such a simple matter to realize that these dead bodies would not feel anything by our amateurish efforts upon them. They were just like a suit of old clothes which had been discarded and which would be cut up perhaps to make other garments. No. The academic matter was difficult at first, but eventually I was able to take my place quite near the top of the class. At about this time I noticed that there was a very, very old Buddhist priest who was giving lectures at the university, and I made some inquiries and was told, "Oh, you don't want to bother about him, he's just an old crackpot. He's weird." Well, that persuaded me that I would have to do extra work and attend the old crackpot's lectures. It was well worthwhile. I formally requested permission to attend and was gladly accepted. A few lectures later, we were all sitting down and our lecturer entered. As was the custom, we rose and remained standing until he told us to be seated. Then he said, "There is no death." No death, I thought, oh, there is going to be a lecture on the occult. He is going to call death transition, which, after all, is what it is. But the old lecturer let us stew in our own impatience for a time, and then he chuckled and went on, "I mean that literally. If we only knew how we could prolong life indefinitely. Let us look at the process of aging, and then I hope you will see what I mean." He said, "A child is born and follows a certain pattern of growth. At a varying age, it varies according to each person. Real development is stated to have stopped, real worthwhile growth has stopped, and from then on there is what is known as the degeneration of old age, where we get a tall man becoming shorter as his bones shrink." He looked about to see if we were following, and when he saw my particular interest he nodded and smiled most amiably. He continued, "A person has to be rebuilt cell by cell, so that if we get a cut, part of the brain has to remember the pattern of the flesh before the cut, and then must supply identical, or near identical, cells to repair the defect. Now, every time we move we cause cells to wear out, and all those cells have to be rebuilt, replaced. Without an exact memory we should not be able to rebuild the body as it was." He looked about again, then pursed his lips, and said, "If the body, or rather, if the brain forgets the precise pattern, then the cells may grow wild. They grow according to no previous pattern, and thus those wild cells are called cancer cells. It means that they are cells which have escaped from the control of that part of the brain which should regulate their precise pattern. Thus it is, you get a person with great growths on his body. That is caused by cells growing in haphazard fashion and which have escaped from the brain's control." He stopped to take a sip of water, and then continued, "Like most of us, the growth and replacing center of the brain has a faulty memory. After reproducing cells for a few thousand times it forgets the precise pattern, and with each succeeding growth of cells there is a difference, so eventually we have that which we call aging. Now, if we could remind the brain constantly of the exact shape and size of each cell to be replaced, then the body would always appear to be of the same age, always appear to be the same condition. In short, we would have immortality except in the case of total destruction of the body or damage to the cells." I thought of this, and then it came to me in a flash that my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, had told me the same thing in somewhat different words, and I had been too young, or too stupid, or both, to understand what he really meant. Our lectures were interesting. We studied so many subjects not studied in the West. In addition to ordinary Western type of medicine and surgery, we studied acupuncture and herbal remedies, but it wasn't all work and no play, although nearly so. One day when I was out with a friend, we wandered down to the shore of the rivers, and there we saw an aeroplane which had been parked and just left for some reason.